a beautiful Tuesday afternoon out there. And here we are downtown on Queen Street at CFBU, and we've got a special guest joining us in the studio. Joining me is Hugo Cheshire. He's the Director of Policy and Government Relations at the Greater Niagara Chamber of Commerce. They are one of the largest business organizations here in Niagara. He's here to talk all about budget, so thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Now, the budget came out about a week ago, and when budgets typically come out, we can expect usually certain responses from certain organizations. Typically, student organizations say there's not enough in there to decrease costs of education. Right. Business organizations like your own typically come out and talk about reducing the deficit, reducing red tape, and reducing taxes. Your report that has come out, or your comments, let's say, on that budget, do include those things. However, I did notice that there was something a little different in there this time. And you talk about affordable housing and how the government needs to do more about that. So can you explain why that's in there?
Sure. Well, we do like to be unpredictable. That's not the primary reason, of course. So at the GNCC, our mission is the region at its social and economic best, because we realize that we can't really be prosperous while there is poverty. While there are social issues, and so really to have a prosperous Niagara, which is what we seek to develop, you have to tackle these issues as well. So we made this part of our platform, and we've been getting more involved recently with issues like affordable housing and poverty and so forth. And we know, even just from a purely economic perspective, poverty costs Niagara at least $1.3 billion a year. Conservative estimate, most likely much higher. And that's money that we all have to pay into. That's money that businesses have to pay, whether it's through taxes, or it's through charitable contributions, or just through loss of economic opportunity. That's a cost that they have to bear. So we made that part of our mission as well, to tackle those issues of poverty. And so affordable housing is a crisis in Niagara. And if we're to move forward and be prosperous as a region, we really need to tackle that here.
Now, those figures you're quoting, the 1.3 some odd billion, I believe that's 2012 figures. Yes. And from the Niagara Community Observatory, they broke that down. How much was unemployment? How much was crime-based? All those things. Now, some people might question you in particular, your organization in particular, coming out and making comments on this, because flashback at least a year or more, and the chamber, I believe, was speaking out against raising minimum wage to the $15 mark because of the impact that would have on the retail sector in particular and the service sector. So some people might say, well, wait a minute. On one hand, you are questioning raising the wages so that there's a livable wage, which in this area is $17 to $18, I think, so that people can afford rent. And on the other hand, you're now saying, hey, they need to do more about affordable housing, which ultimately, if they did, that money to build is going to have to come from somewhere, certainly the private sector, but also usually there are subsidies involved in that, which again, I come from the government. So how can you justify those things, I guess?
Right, right. Well, first of all, to quote Facebook, it's complicated. And there are many facets behind this. I just want to clarify our position on the minimum wage increase as well, which was that we were never opposed to raising minimum wage per se. In fact, when the government had its previous scheme where minimum wage was increased in line with inflation, we were in favor of that. The issue that we see is that, well, first of all, even $14, $15 an hour is not at the level of a living wage, which is, I believe, $17.99 in Niagara now. So we're still not there. And had the Liberal government not frozen minimum wage for, I believe, it's 5 years, and the Conservative government for 9 years before that, we could be there. We could be beyond there now. But the issue was that because it gets ignored and then it gets treated like a political football, instead of having these regular, easy to adjust to increases that can bring us up there, we essentially have nothing done for many years and then suddenly very, very large increases, which are really, really challenging for businesses to adjust to. So our position was not that you shouldn't increase minimum wage, but you need to do it not all at once. You need to phase it in gradually, let businesses adjust, let everyone get up there in a slow fashion. Don't try and jump to the top of the cliff. And that was essentially our position. So I'm all in favor of a living wage, but we have to get in a way that's sustainable and realistic rather than kicking this around. And now we may see the pattern repeated again where it is frozen and then not increased for a while. We'd rather see that regular pattern of predictable increases come back. So that's where we are on minimum wage.
And some people might argue, well, we've been waiting forever for that and it hasn't happened, because if you leave it to the corporations, why would they raise those wages unless they cannot find workers, right?
Well, what we're talking about here is still a government-mandated minimum wage, of course, and we recognize that does have to go up to account for increases in cost of living and nothing else. It just has to be in a predictable and regular fashion, and businesses can adjust to that, and that's fine. What they have a hard time adjusting to is no change for years, and then suddenly a big $2, $3, $4-an-hour jump. It's very hard to adjust to for businesses in retail and low-margin enterprises.
Now, here in Niagara, if I've understood the stats correctly, a large part of our employment is around retail and wholesale trade. And this budget, one of the comments that you made as the chamber, talks about training and the money that they're putting into that. So can you address that?
Sure. Well, the training money is always good, because one of the key complaints we hear from employers, and this is not just in Niagara, but all across Ontario, and I believe in Canada as well, is one of the biggest challenges they face is finding talent, finding skilled people. So if the government's investing more money in training workers, that's obviously a good thing. And so we'd like to see this investment. We think it's a good investment to actually put money into training, to creating new jobs and new skilled opportunities. The one issue that we have was that we wonder if there's enough here to support micro businesses, because what this legislation in the budget is going to do is allow workers to take time off to go train, which is great. But if you only have one or two employees and one of them announces, oh, yes, I'm taking time off for training, that could really leave you in a bind as a business. So are there any measures we could take to help businesses out in that situation? And I'm not saying that I don't want workers to get trained. Of course, we absolutely do. But we want to make sure that that's been covered as well for the employers who are going to lose those employees while they're off.
And there's so many issues here locally, well, everywhere around employment, especially youth employment. We know that youth here in Niagara are traditionally a little underrepresented in the workforce. Plus the fact that the majority of jobs available are retail, service, tourist industry stuff, underemployed in terms of not necessarily full-time employment. And then you've got this other thing where we need to get skilled workers because there's a shortage of skilled workers. So how do you balance that locally when those jobs don't exist in the first place here locally?
The skilled jobs?
Yes.
Well, a lot of part of it is the workforce, right? I mean, if you are an employer and you're seeking to open a new location, you generally want to go where you know there's a workforce available for you. And if Niagara does not have that skilled workforce, we're not going to get the employers here. We're not going to get the jobs here. I remember recently, I forget which firm it was, but it was a firm that needed to urgently hire a few hundred welders, and they couldn't find them. You know, and that's a major problem. But if you have that body of skilled workers here, then I think that the employers will come to our location. But right now, if we don't have them, we're not going to get the jobs.
Okay, let's walk through the budget and the typical things that you address. Number one, the deficit.
The deficit, yes. So the debt and the deficit is, I think we can sort of say this is good and bad at the same sort of time. Now, Canada's debt, when you look at it overall as an absolute number, it looks staggering. But in terms of in international terms, we're actually doing not badly on our terms of our national debt. And what we generally look at is the debt to GDP ratio. So just on what that is. So the GDP is if you add up all the products and services a country produces in a year and put that together, and that's a rough measure of how big the economy is. And your debt to GDP ratio, therefore, is how much debt you have versus the size of your economy or your ability to repay it. It's like if you owe $10,000 on your credit card and you work for minimum wage, that's kind of a problem. But if you owe $10,000 and you make $250,000 a year, you're probably fine. Same amount of debt, but totally different perspective on what that debt means. So by that perspective, we're actually doing okay. And the debt to GDP ratio is forecasted to fall, even though actual indebtedness is going up because the economy is going to grow and so on. So that's the side that looks good. The side that looks bad, of course, is what if the economy doesn't grow? What if there is a recession? And usually we don't go more than about 10 years between recessions. Now we're heading into year 11 between recessions. It seems likely one's around the corner. So if that happens, what happens to the debt? And we will need to build up more debt in a recession because you have fewer companies, fewer businesses, fewer people paying taxes because of the recession. But you also have more demand on government services. So your debt goes up. So the concern in going to recession, if you've already built up a sizable debt and a large deficit, there's nothing left in the tank for your recession. So that's something we're urging a bit of caution on this, is leave a bit in reserve in case we do fall in harder times. And generally as well, just because the debt is available or our debt is low is not necessarily a good reason in and of itself to spend it. I'm sure we all know someone when they get a letter from the bank saying we've increased your credit card limit $5,000. They say, oh, great, $5,000. What can I go out and spend this on? We're like, okay, slow down. That's not actually your money. That's available money. And the same sort of approach is true here as well. And it can get us into rabbit holes where we can't, for example, raise interest rates, even though we might want to as a policy tool. It would certainly do something to cool off the housing market if you raise interest rates. But if the government is heavily indebted and private citizens are heavily indebted, then raising interest rates can really, really hurt them because those debt servicing charges go through the roof. And if you are heavily in debt, that takes away that policy tool from you. So just because you are doing well on debt and there's a big ceiling available to you is not sufficient reason by itself to build up a big debt. That's what we're saying.
Now, we are so used to being compared to our partner to the south, and especially this year with their debt and the things that are going on there. Is Canada looking actually fairly good compared to them for investors, or maybe not so much because our dollar is
in down terms of indebtedness, certainly, yes. Their debt GDP ratio is, I think, more than double ours. So their government is much more heavily indebted. That being said, the federal government, at least in the US, has been doing a lot more to clear the way for businesses, reducing the regulatory burden and reducing red tape. And we're worried, the Chamber Network as a whole is worried, that unless we mirror that to some extent in Canada, we could end up losing business as it goes down south, because businesses don't really care about Donald Trump or anything else that's going on down there. What they care about is what's the cost of doing business. And if it's much lower in the States, that's a reason to relocate. We don't want to see that.
And when it comes to reducing red tape, if we look again to the south, environmental things have been cut and many, many people support the environment. So I think when people hear organizations like yours talking about cutting red tape, cutting regulations, that's what they think. Oh, they're going to go after the, we'll be breathing in coal dust. So let's talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, sure. Well, we're not in favor of everyone breathing in coal dust, obviously. That's not good for anyone. That's not the region at its social and economic best, let's be clear. When we talk about reducing red tape, what we're honestly looking at is a lot of duplicate regulations or regulations that are contradictory or regulations that overlap between the provincial and the federal governments. Maybe things that just can be eliminated. And taxes is a big one as well. We did talk about the tax system in our release, but maybe this is a good segue into that. Where the taxation system, this system is now, it's been decades since the tax system was really overhauled and looked at seriously in Canada, since which time you've had all sorts of loopholes added and new taxes added on this and that, because it's a policy tool for governments. You can say we want to encourage a certain kind of investment or behavior, so we'll give it a tax break. And we want to discourage another kind of investment or behavior, so we'll put more taxes on that. And successive governments doing this for decades and decades builds up this really enormous and incomprehensible edifice of taxation law. And so this is an example of really where you could cut some red tape and some bureaucracy just by taking a new look at the tax system and saying, okay, let's break it down to a very simple system. Let's try and eliminate a lot of this stuff, try and accomplish the policy goals that we want to accomplish without these layers upon layers upon layers of rules and regulations that are built up over time. How can we simplify that, you know, accomplish our goals, still get the tax revenue without making everyone need to have a team of accountants and lawyers to do the tax returns for their business?
When the average person who is not a business owner hears organizations like yours talking about tax cuts for businesses, people sometimes think, okay, wait a minute, you know, I'm paying 30, 40 or more percentage in personal income tax. Corporations are paying maybe 15, if that, if they're paying. So how can you justify those things?
It depends on the corporation, right? I mean, certainly at the Chamber, the vast majority of businesses that we represent are small businesses. And I think it's important to remember that small businesses are generally in the same boat as taxpayers. They're usually paying more in taxes than giant multinational corporations. And they're picking up the shortfall when those giant multinational corporations are not paying their fair share. So we're not really in favor of a big business. I mean, as a business advocate, I can honestly say that big businesses generally take care of themselves pretty well. What I'm here for, what the Chamber is here for, is the little guy, essentially. It's not the large corporation, but the mom and pop shop, the solopreneur, the small business, who are often making less than they would making for a wage. I know quite a lot of restaurateurs who would actually make more if they just went to work for McDonald's. You know, it's sad, but that's who we're looking out for. So when we're talking about easing the tax burdens, it's really on people like that. Business owners who are probably making less than minimum wage themselves.
And when it comes to helping businesses succeed, there has been in the past numerous attempts to get small businesses off the ground, incubators, all sorts of things. And even now, no efforts to do that, because in the past we've heard stats that the largest employers are typically small business owners sometimes. But the risk is obviously greater, and they may not necessarily last as long as those giant corporations. So what's the answer? Where should we be focusing?
Well, something we've noticed a lot is that it seems to be the issue is not starting your business, it's going to the next level. If you want to start a business, especially if you're young, there are a lot of supports available, a lot of grants, incubator spaces, and so on and so forth. The difficulty is when you are somewhat established and you want to transition now from being a startup into an established business, that's when a lot of those supports and that money tends to dry up. And that's where we really want to help businesses, is not just to establish themselves, but to grow. How do you get to the point where you're now not just starting your business, but you're hiring people, you're creating jobs? That's the gap, I think, that needs to be filled in.
And that gap is usually money, isn't it?
Generally speaking, it's hard. It's money. It's also skills as well, because a lot of people may have the skills required to do the job, but not necessarily to run the business. So say you're a plumber. You can be the world's greatest plumber, but you don't know anything about taxes or payroll or accounting or hiring or HR, and you really need to know about these things if you are to actually grow your business to hire people, right? And that skills gap is where things can be problematic as well. So we're asking not just in terms of grants and money, but also supports in terms of skills to help a business actually grow, to provide the skills, to fill in the skills gap that they have, to hire people and become an employer rather than just a solopreneur.
And can we talk about robots for a minute?
We can talk about robots, yes.
So from an employee's perspective, the robots are coming. That's something that we cannot ignore, especially when we're talking wages and finding workers and all of that. So what, at this moment in time, where are you at on that?
It's an interesting question. I think there's a lot of different studies and reports on this, and some are saying that robots will replace our jobs. Other ones are saying, no, we're more likely to be working alongside a robot that may take some of our responsibilities and so on. And it's definitely a challenge, and I think it's a policy question that governments have yet to solve and really need to look at seriously. So when you look at manufacturing, for example, it's the common refrain that all the manufacturing jobs have gone to Mexico. And that's not really true. About 85% of the manufacturing jobs lost in North America have actually gone to automation. And there's a school of thought that says that's probably as it should be, because factory work is boring and it's dangerous and it's often dirty and it's not really good work. And, you know, my parents' generation who worked in factories, their greatest ambition was for their children not to work in factories, right? That's not good work. But then the question is, of course, what replaces those jobs? And that's a policy question I think we have to answer. And we're kind of chipping around the edges with more emphasis on coding and the knowledge economy and so on. But how is that really enough to sustain all the jobs that we need it to? Does it need to be something more? I think this is a question that people really have to acknowledge and look at more. Is the knowledge economy alone enough to replace manufacturing and all the jobs that robots are going to replace? And if not, what else do we need?
And you can't help but sympathize for young people who might be thinking, especially in Niagara, here we are, service jobs, retail jobs, maybe not paying the best, maybe precarious employment. Robots aren't going to be doing that stuff. It'll be humans, the lowly humans that are...
Yes, it could be, yes. The thing is, as well, is that, I know this is a tired refrain, but there's always money in the trades, right? It's impossible to offshore that. You can't outsource your plumber to Mexico. It's possible, I suppose, in many years that we could have robot plumbers, but I don't see this being a very easy job to replace. Mm-hmm. And additionally, there's just not enough people going into these fields. I think we have 26% of new jobs that will be created in Ontario will be in the skilled trades, but only 18% of young people are interested in going into skilled trades. So there's plenty of room there. And I would say, like, if you really are afraid of being made obsolete by a robot, and this is not a social solution, this is more of an individual solution, but skilled trades might be worth a look.
Is there anything else within the recent budget that we haven't covered that you'd like to mention?
Well, the one big win that we did see, of course, was the interprovincial trade. And we were very pleased to see the federal government announcing that it's going to be taking down its barriers to interprovincial trade, particularly in alcoholic beverages. And obviously in Niagara, this is, you know, wine is kind of a big deal around here, right? So we're very glad to see this. Now, of course, the ball is now in the province's court. But the federal government has sent a very strong signal that we want to see these trade barriers down. Whether or not we can actually follow up on that with the provinces is a separate question, but it's definitely a big step in the right direction, and we were very pleased to see that.
Well, it's interesting because I think that there are still a number of people out there that don't realize that you can't buy wine or beer and bring it across the provincial...
No.
I grew up on a grape farm, and I did not even know that until a few years ago. So
it's true, and it's silly. You can buy guns and move them across provincial borders, but not a bottle of wine, which is ludicrous to me. yeah, it's definitely something that we should fix. And when you put it that way, the silliness of it is apparent, right? That we really should do something about it. It's ridiculous that I can't buy wine in Quebec and just drive across back to Ontario when we are the same country.
The Chamber has some events that are coming up. You've been doing some surveys recently, and you've got some information on your website.
Yep, we do. Yeah, so what's coming up fast is the first CHES State of the Region address. That's on April 3rd at the Scotiabank Centre. And this will be Chair Bradley's first address as regional chair, and he'll be joined by a panel of business people and people from nonprofits and social services on stage talking about the future of Niagara. So if you're interested in municipal politics, that's the must-see event, I think. And then on the 26th, we have our AGM, and at the AGM, we're tackling the big topic right now, which is governance reform. We've gotten together a panel of experts, including some academics. We have Mayor Eisenberger from Hamilton. We have some people in economic development and civil servants who've been through the amalgamation process and know a bit about that. So we're attempting to tease out there what governance reform is going to mean from Niagara, what the opportunities are, what the potential pitfalls are. So if you're curious about this topic at all, again, that's a must-see event. And more information about those is on our website, which is gncc.ca.
And you will be releasing the results of your surveys, yes?
I think they're actually already up on that website, too. So again, same website, gncc.ca, if you're interested in our governance reform survey. We did make the results public, so please go and check it out. And the provinces survey is open right now as well. So if you do have thoughts to share, the link to that, you can get onto that through our website as well. But tell the province what you think, what you want to see. They are open to suggestions right now.
I went and looked at that survey, and I did find it a bit odd, the questions, the way they're worded. If someone really isn't totally familiar with municipal government and the inner workings of it, they might have some challenges answering some of those questions.
There's no yes, no, or checkbox questions there. It's really just a series of text boxes, and they want your thoughts. And that might be a good thing, because I think they just want to hear from people who've considered this and have sort of a grasp of the issue, rather than people who are just maybe angry at some of the personalities in government and want to express that in a way that's perhaps not constructive. So pros and cons, but if you do have strong thoughts, then the province wants to hear you. And from everything I've heard, they are actually taking the time to come up with a solution. They want to listen to what Niagara has to say. They want your input. So it's actually valuable. It's not going to go into a black hole somewhere and the decision is going to be made in a smoky back room somewhere. They're actually going to listen to what we have to say.
Okay. We've been speaking with Hugo Cheshire, the Director of Policy and Government Relations at the Niagara Chamber of Commerce. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.